Privilege to welcome Rabbi Moshe Katz.
Check it out, somebody. Thank
you. Good morning. I can hack a Chinook while we get hand out the sheets here. I always say I've been here before, and I always have very warm feelings being here. First of all, because the Kollel and its members is very. Precious in my eyes. I think they contributed a tremendous amount to our community. I've always mentioned in the past that I always have warm feelings because I grew up with Rabbi Brand's dad, went to yeshiva together, camped together for many years. Suffice it to say that when I think about the things that we did together, to project that someday his son will be a respected Rosh Kollel and that I would be speaking at his Kollel, suffice it to say that you have to be a Navi. So we'll leave it at that. But it really is an honor to be here. Talking about chesed, I wanted to open up with one story that I just think about when you talk about internalizing chesed and obligation to other people. This was at the Levaya Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal. His grandson told a story that Rav Aaron was in the hospital very often, and obviously, as you would expect, the staff sensed that he was somebody special, a very spiritual person. And he was being discharged shortly before Pesach. And the nurse said to Rabbi Soloveitchik, "Have a wonderful Passover, and please give me a blessing for Good Friday." His grandson said he knew two things. One, Rabbi Aaron knew what Good Friday was in Jewish history, and he was not comfortable with that. He also knew that somehow he's not going to hurt this person's feelings. Somehow he's going to come up with something. Without missing a beat, he says to her, "Have a good Friday, a good Saturday, a good Sunday, and a good Monday." That's how a genius applies, just instinctively, sensitivity to other people, even when you have to sort of come up with something creative. I want to tell you a little bit about the evolution of this shiur. It's called Einstein, Torah, and the Big Bang. A number of years ago, they came out with a story about a letter. Einstein wrote a letter. It was being sold for $300,000. And, you know, his views about God and religion are kind of hard to figure out because he expressed himself differently at different times. In this letter, he said, "God for me is nothing more than the product of human weaknesses. The Bible is a collection of honorable but still primitive legends, which are nevertheless pretty childish. And the Jewish people to whom I gladly belong have no different quality for me than all other people." Basically, the Torah is full of legends, which are childish, nothing special about the Jewish people. So I decided that I wanted to give a shiur at CTN to address this, because first of all, you mentioned to Maimonides, people don't come running. You mention Einstein, you get their attention, and unfortunately, certainly to the first part. And I wanted to give an example of a legend in the Torah and see for themselves whether it's childish or whether it's profound. Just in passing, the last thing that he says, nothing special about the Jewish people, that's an amazing statement. I always tell people that we should realize that the Jewish people are 1.5% of the American population. The United Jewish Fund, depending on the year, is second, third, or fourth largest charity in America. That's something pretty special. So I chose this story of Avraham Avinu and the guests. First of all, I want to apologize. I noticed that on the right side, the Hebrew, the first letter is a little bit cut off. I usually focus on the left side when I give this class. So basically, this is a story I'm sure we're familiar with. Certainly, generally, it's Avraham and the guests. So we're going to focus primarily on the first half of it. I always ask people to. I always tell people that, you know, when we study Torah, we have to have the reverence, of course. At the same time, too much reverence, we say, "Who am I to ask any questions?" And therefore, we don't learn from it. So I always tell people, take a red pen as if you're marking a literature essay and circle anything that sounds bizarre or redundant or overdramatic or misplaced, you know, and then we'll come to it. So beginning with, it says, "Vayera Elav Hashem." Hashem appeared to him. If you were marking an essay, what might you say?
God appeared to him. If God doesn't have a body, all what does appear mean in this context?
Okay, well, that's a like, very philosophical. That's a very good question. I meant more a little bit more just the basic in the text. That's a very good question. I've never been asked that in this context before. Very good question, but I'm not sure that's beyond the scope of this conversation, which usually means beyond the scope of the speaker knowledge. But in this case, Hashem appeared to him. He started an essay. Hashem appeared to him. Who's him? Of course, you know, not clear. Then it says, Vayisa Einav Vayar. He lifts his eyes and he saw. And behold, three people standing above him. Would anyone circle anything here? Again, you want the people to be taught how to write properly, appropriately, accurately, not overly dramatic. You know, if you were writing this, you want to write that a person sitting at his tent and he sees three people. What would you say? Sitting at his tent and he saw three people. You don't say he lifted his eyes. Every time you say somebody saw something, you don't say he lifted his eyes. And you don't say, behold, three people. That's over dramatic here. Like, you know, okay, it sounds like a nice story, but okay, he saw three people, and he saw three people walking towards him. I have on the bottom here, in case sometimes people suspect that maybe it's just like biblical poetry, the Torah speaks that way in poetry, he lifted his eyes. On the bottom we have the story with Lot, which is so much similar, but much different, obviously, than Avram Avinu. It says over there that he sat at the gate. The Lot saw. He saw three people. He saw guests. He saw. Right. So here it says he lifted his eyes, and he saw, and behold, three people. Also, overly dramatic. Yes, or am I being over too picky? Yes, overly dramatic. Okay. Then it says, Vayar, he saw. And he ran towards them. Would we circle a word here?
Vayar repeated.
Again, right, repetition, right? He saw. It says that he saw, and it says again that he saw. Okay, and then Vayomar on Gimel, this is the famous one, Adonai yonam atzasi chen de'inecha, anos avor miyal avdecha. Right, so here is lack of clarity. Who is he speaking? Who's he speaking to? I'm sure some of you are familiar with this discussion, but basically he saw three people. Right, and he says, "He's my master. Please don't leave." Then he proceeds to prepare an entire banquet for his guests. Right, so here's a lack of clarity. Who is he talking to over here? And what would you think simply when you read the story? By the way, I looked up this letter from Einstein. He has something else. He said all the brilliant explanations don't satisfy him because they have nothing to do with the text. I'm sure sometimes he's seen your wild pshatim, you know, but nothing to do with the text. You know, if you read the text in English, you miss the whole issue over here. Right? But he said, my master, don't leave. Who's he speaking to? Most obviously would be to the guests, right? You know, please don't leave. I want to serve you, right? And what's the problem with that?
Singular,
right? He says that there were three people. He says singular, right? So some of them are farshim who are pshat oriented. Say that maybe of the three, there was one that was clearly the leader or the most important, and he's speaking to that person. So that's a problem if he's speaking to the guests, right? You know, sometimes I tell people when I live with somebody, and they say, "Well, it's obviously like this," you know. And I say, "You know, you say obviously because we're molded by the Torah for 3,000 years. You know, the Romans didn't talk that way. Well, of course, a poor person you have to have consideration, sensitivity. The Romans didn't talk that way. You know, things are obvious to us after thousands of years." Right, we would never think of the other possibility. Right, what's the other possibility?
Speaking to God.
Would never enter anyone's mind because what it says there doesn't make sense. Right, he says to God, "God, please don't leave. I'm gonna take care of these three guys." And I think we can really appreciate it when we think about being a phone conversation. It's like, puts you on hold to take another phone call. How do we feel about that? Not. Thrilling experience, right? When we're talking to somebody breaks off and they go to talk to somebody else. So we never enter in anyone's mind that he tells the creator of the universe, please don't leave, I want to take care of these three guests. Right? But as many of you I'm sure know, that's one of the views in the Gemara. Rashi cites both explanations. Here's something very interesting, which means I think it's interesting. Usually when you have a disagreement about a pshat and a pasuk in a non-halachic context, halacha doesn't decide. Doesn't take a stand. Right? Zekeli ve'anvehu. So what does the word ve'anvehu mean? Rashi says one thing, I will declare Hashem's beauty. The Targum says, I will build anvehu like noveh, a dwelling place. I will build the dwelling place for Hashem. Rehersh says the same thing, but I will be, I make myself a dwelling place for Hashem. Ve'anvehu, I will be a temple for Hashem. Halacha doesn't take a stand there because it doesn't have any practical ramifications. In this particular case, of this interpretation, what this word is referring to, there's a halacha about this. It's actually interesting. I've never seen anyone refer to this other than Rav Hirsch. He makes mention of this. The halacha has a decision about what this word means. Does anyone have any idea why it would be relevant to halacha? Which of these two interpretations is accepted? Is he referring to the guest or the guests or to Hashem or to God? There's a halacha that depends on this.
He allows to leave the kavod of one's rav, a respected person, in order to take care of strangers.
Oh, that's good. I'm not sure. I think that the issue is not whether we accept this principle that hachnas arachim is greater than having the Shekhinah. I think it's just a question of whether this pasuk is saying it. Right? I forgot to say that those who say that it's referring to Hashem means that he's saying to Hashem, Hashem, you wait, I'm going to take care of these guests. From this we see that it's greater to take care of the guests than to speak to Hashem, to be Kabbal Lashkina. I don't think that the issue is whether we accept that or not. I think it's just a question of the interpretation of the Pasuk, I think. But there is a fascinating halacha, because when a sofer writes a Sefer Torah, when he writes Hashem's name, he has to have kavan, he has the intent for the kedusha of Hashem's name. So then we have to know, what is this Hashem's name or not? So the Rambam has a whole list of the names of Hashem where they appear in the Torah, and he lists this as an example of Hashem's name. That means the sofer has to have intent when he writes this word that it's referring to Hashem. So it would seem that the halacha accepts that second interpretation, that he's talking to Hashem. So the question is, very nice, it sounds very beautiful and poetic, but what does it mean? I once heard of Noach Weinberg speak, and he presented this question, and he said, if you'd ask any thinking person, what could be the most spiritual experience you could possibly have? Any thinking person would say, if God would speak to me, after the Michael Jordan stuff, get serious, if God would appear to me, that would be the most spiritual experience possible. He said, if he'd ask an atheist, atheist would say, I don't believe in God, but if there was a God, and he would appear to me, that would be the most spiritual thing, right? And here we say that taking care of a guest is greater, more spiritual than speaking to Hashem. So it's a beautiful sounding, beautiful poetic lesson, but what does it mean? So I want to share with you two ideas. The first one is, and I think quite a few of us say this, that what could be greater than speaking to Hashem? Being like Hashem. Emulating Hashem. It's very nice. You speak, you dive, and you speak, you connect to Hashem. The greatest connection is emulating Hashem, trying to be godly. So when you take care of the needs of someone else, of a guest in need, you're being godly. And that is more spiritual than speaking to Hashem. By the way, it's interesting that you think about it in terms of who these three people were. These were not three guys from Avraham Avinu's shul, from his chevra. The world was pagan at that time. So these three guys, we assume, were pagans. The Medrash actually says that one of them was a baker, one was a sailor, and one was an Arab. That's what the Medrash says. It's trying to, I think, make the point that we should realize that these people are not, hachnas arachim, having a guest. Like, we like to have a guest who's witty and worldly and traveled around the world and fascinating conversation and a sense of humor, right? The less glamorous, sometimes we don't run, right? Here, the example in the Torah of hachnas arachim is three pagans, a sailor, a baker, whatever, and Avraham Avinu treats them like royalty. Right? And I'd like to suggest that the reason why it says Vayar, if you notice in the English, on the fifth line, he perceived. This, the translation is obviously addressing the fact that of the redundancy. So it says the second one was Vayar, he saw something deeper. And Rashi also mentions this, that Vayar means he saw something deeper. What did he see? So I always like to think that what he saw was, he saw three people, pagans. So on one level, nothing in common with them. They're pagans. I'm connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a creator, Bari Olam, no connection. He just had his bris milah, which stamped kedusha, holiness on him. So at first glance, there's nothing in common. Then Vayar, he looked deeper, and he realized that Tzelem Elokim, in the person. I always still like to tell a story of this guy's pulled over by a policeman and says, he says, "Sir, you just went through a, didn't you see the stop sign?" He says, "Yes, sir, I saw the stop sign. Problem is, I didn't see you." Right? Right? And I like to take this to apply it sometimes to daily life. You know, sometimes you can picture a Kodesh Baruch is asking to us, like saying to us, "Didn't you notice that this person needed a little bit of your time? And you didn't notice, you didn't stop, right? Or you were talking, you were sharing some gossip about this person, and this person was uneasy. You could have stopped, right? And you didn't." So the cute thing to see would be to say that, "Yeah, Hashem, I noticed that. I didn't notice you," which is also true on a certain level. But the real answer that it would be, "Yes, Hashem, I saw that person. I didn't see you in that person. I lost sight of the Tzelem Elokim in that person." I have this experience often on, I'm sure others have also seen it, I think it's on McCormick, on Tui and McCormick, there's a light there, and often there are homeless people standing there, and I always give everybody, people always ask me, should you give to everybody? I always tell people that when a Jew says no to somebody in need, you become less sensitive. The bulk of our tzedakah has to be, of course, the things that we know for sure are legitimate, but you never say no to a Jew. Right? Especially in the day when we'll go to Starbucks and plop down $3 for a coffee, or go on the way to Mariano to get my grilled salmon, I'm going to give the guy a quarter, you know. So so they usually stand in the middle over there at a red light. So I usually give the guy a quarter. I think he recognized me by now. So one day I was there, and he was on the other side because he moved to the other side. And I had time. I rolled down the window on the other side, and I got his attention. So he said to me, "Thank you for noticing me." Itself was a nice, a good feeling. Then again, I said, I think Kiviyachal, I would say, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu noticed, he would say, "Moshe Katz, thank you for noticing me in him." You notice, because you notice the Tzelem Elokim. So Vayar, he saw them, but then he saw deeper and penetrated deeper, and he realized the Tzelem Elokim. He goes on to to take care of them. A second way of looking at this, I saw in the Nesiva Shalom, which also I thought a very uplifting idea. He says, think about you get a call from your best friend from high school days. That's a good example. High school days or college, whatever, you know, and you haven't seen him in years. And he's coming to Chicago for a few days. Right? So you take a few days off from work, you treat him like royalty because he's an old friend. You love him. Right? That's one. Picture getting a phone call, not from your friend, but from a kid that you don't know. And the kid says, "I'm so-and-so's son, your old buddy's son. I'm coming to Chicago. I'd like to meet you." You take off a few days from work and treat that kid like royalty. In which case have you shown your friend greater love? The son. Because the son, you don't even know the son, but because he's the son of that friend, I will take off time and treat that child like royalty. So that's what he says, that every time you connect to Hashem, that's one, that's wonderful, that's spiritual. You take care of his child. That's the deepest show of love to Hashem. Right? So that's the teaching, that's greater to take care of the needs of a person in need, in this case a guest, than to speak to Hashem. And of course it elevates how we should look at our interactions with other people. Now on to the Big Bang. I'm sure you all know, and basically to sum up just in a few sentences my entire knowledge of this old concept. I'm sure we all know that the current thinking is that the world had a beginning, there was a Big Bang. By the way, I always tell people that until around 60, 70 years ago when this theory came around, if you'd ask somebody, how far do you have to read in the Torah until you reach a point where any person with a scientific background would say, that's ridiculous, I can't accept that. How far would you have to get into the Torah before you reach such a point?
The very first word,
in Hebrew it's one word, Bereshit, in the beginning. If this was 60 years ago, everyone would say, that's ridiculous. You want me to sell my brains? Everyone knows, science knows, you can't possibly have something from nothing. It's impossible for there to be a beginning. Einstein himself was opposed to this whole concept. Right? They have in his writings where he wrote this talk about a beginning gets him angry. Which a lot of people have pointed out that scientists aren't supposed to speak that way. Scientists are supposed to say, let's examine the evidence calmly and dispassionately. got angry, right? Because beginning gets people nervous, because beginning makes you think that it was something that triggered it. In any case, so I always tell people, if the first word turned out to be true, it's worth reading the rest of the book. We got the first word right. So that was the theory, and it's because the universe is expanding. If it's expanding, that means if you go back, it's getting smaller, till there was nothing, and then there was a beginning. But there was no proof for it. And then this fellow, Arno Penzias, working at Bell Labs in New Jersey, who he's actually an observant Jew. I was told that he became observant as a result of this. I'm not sure about that, but he is an observant Jew. And they were playing around with a very sophisticated antenna in Bell Labs, and they heard this buzzing that they couldn't figure out where this buzzing was coming from. And in fact, it was a time they thought maybe it was pigeon droppings. They cleaned the whole thing up, and they killed the pigeons, the whole story. They couldn't figure it out. Finally, they concluded, based on different predictions of based on the Big Bang, that what they were hearing was a residue of the Big Bang. Like there's some radiation permeating the entire universe, and it's a residue from the Big Bang, and there's actually a term that they use for it. And you know what it's called? It's called the echo of the Big Bang. Yeah, the Big Bang, and then this radiation throughout the universe is the echo of the Big Bang. So what was the Big Bang? So there are basically two choices. Either the Big Bang was just this accident we can't explain, somehow there's a huge explosion, and that somehow as a result of that the whole universe evolved, and somehow we're here. So basically, that's one possibility. Basically, that scenario means, as much as people will try to wiggle out of it, it means that there's no meaning to anything. We're just here by accident, and that's it. Meaningless. I always would tell people that we are a speck on a speck in the universe. Not only are we specks, the Earth, the whole Earth, is a speck in the universe. I read this around a year ago, and since then I keep telling it to everybody. I'm going wild over it. Everyone knows that the sun is larger than the Earth. How much larger than the Earth is the sun? How many Earths could you fit in the sun? Anybody know? Everyone says hundreds, thousands. Answer is a million. You can fit a million Earths into the sun. The sun is a million times larger than the Earth. So we are, the Earth is a speck in the universe. In fact, today many scientists think that, how many universes are there? Many scientists believe that there are many universes or infinite universes. Even our universe might be a speck in the whole universe. So there's just nothing important about us. People look for meaning. Sometimes people will say, well, I'll help humanity. That would be meaningful. So once a cute metaphor from Abraham Twersky, he says there was a town that had a curfew, and they caught two teenagers outside after the curfew. So they come before the judge. The judge says to the first one, what were you doing outside after the curfew? He said, nothing, Your Honor. He says to the other one, what were you doing? He says, I was helping him. Helping someone do nothing is not meaningful, right? So that's one scenario, right? The other scenario, of course, is that it was not an accident, right? And there was a creator, God, who turned the switch, so to speak, and the Big Bang was something that he did, right, to create the universe, right? And if you ever wonder about, if you ever get philosophical, I'm sure you've thought about this one also, why in the world would God do that? What does he need this whole big headache for? So in the classical explanations of our tradition, based on the Ramchal and on the Pasuk Olam Chesed Yibaneh, is that God created the world because God is a mative. His essence is to be good and to bestow goodness. So he created the world in order to have an opportunity to have creations so that he can bestow kindness and pleasure upon them. And in case you're wondering if that's the case, why make it so complicated? Why not just create the world and just shower us with blessing? So there too, the tradition says that if you would just create a universe and shower us with blessing, without us having any opportunity to earn it, so what would that be? It would be a handout. Right? And there's a sense, it's called nama de kisufa. There's a sense that when you get a handout, there's an element of shame. But again, at that same place, McCormick and Devon, I had another guy who was standing there, and he had a sign that said, I'm homeless, you know, please help. And on the bottom was a little smiley. So I noticed it, so I gave him again my quarter, and I said, thank you for the smile, you reminded me to smile. So he broke out into this huge smile. Right. So what happened here? What was the mechanics over here? What did I do? It's no brilliant thing. What did I do? Guy standing on the street with asking for a handout, so it's humiliating. What did I do? I made him feel not only like a taker, like a receiver, but a giver. That's a quarter, and thank you for the smiley, right? And that's something godly as well. So Hashem created the world. The Big Bang came about because Hashem wanted to bestow kindness on us. He created this world so that he can give us an opportunity to earn a connection with him, right? So the way I always picture it, I tell people that the Big Bang is either an accident with no meaning, or the Big Bang was a big bang of chesed. Big bang of chesed. Hashem created the world with a big bang of chesed to bestow kindness upon us. And when we do an act of kindness, act of chesed, it's an echo of the original Big Bang. Either you have a meaningless Big Bang with meaningless buzzing throughout the universe, an echo of that Big Bang, or you have a Big Bang of chesed, and an act of kindness is an echo of that Big Bang. But in fact, that little story where you thank the guy for the smiley, if you think about it, it's by the way, when you give a class like this, you start doing things that you didn't do before because you just internalize it. That's what I find in my experience. You take a guy on the corner who's begging, right? And you talk about emulating a Big Bang. You're doing exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did. Chesed, an echo of that Big Bang, and then you try to make him feel like a giver instead of a schnorrer, instead of a receiver, right? So that's what the Big Bang is from a Jewish perspective. So I like to say that I like to think that we could teach Einstein a few things about the Big Bang. Now, if you look at it in that way, and you go back to the story here, so if you have a person who we'd call that person a Baal Chesed, right? Every time they're presented with an opportunity, someone in need, they respond. Anytime they get a phone call, they respond. Always respond. Never turn someone down. Never make believe they don't see. Never miss an opportunity. Is he or she there? Is that the ultimate Baal Chesed according to Torah values? You never miss responding to somebody in need. Is that the ultimate? No, there's another step. What's that? I see you shaking your head.
Teaching someone to provide for yourself.
Oh, okay. That right. Well, that touches on another thing. You're right. That the ultimate chesed is not always giving. The ultimate sometimes is giving the person opportunity or the tools to do it on their own. That's just sometimes that is the ultimate chesed. I want to mention before. You know, some of you may know. In Jewel, in Evanston, I think Skokie, they outlawed plastic disposable bags, right? So you go to Jewel. See, the guys know where Jewel is, guys. After today, maybe you go there more. So in Jewel, they have these big permanent bags that says it can be used, I think, 293 times or something. And on it, one of them says, "I'm saving the planet. What are you doing?" So I like to tell people that I think we should think to ourselves, it's very nice if you want to take care of the ecology, it's fine, but what we're really doing is we are making the earth worth saving. I'm saving the planet. Okay, you're saving a meaningless planet. Our tradition is making the earth worth saving, because we see the Big Bang as I said. So it's true, point well taken, that sometimes the thing to do is not to give the person necessarily, but whatever the proper response to a person in need is, you can respond to a person in need, right? But there's another level. That would be to be proactive, to look for opportunities to help people. It's like the proverbial person who goes down the street putting quarters into people's meters. There's something about that, because he's being proactive and looking for chesed. Right? So responding is not sufficient, right? The highest level of chesed is looking for opportunities. If you go back to the beginning, to the story, Avram is sitting at his tent, right? He lifts up his eyes. What does that tell you, that expression? He's looking for something. Right? We find by actually by three times by Avraham Avinu, right? By the Akedah. So lift up his eyes, he saw Hara Maria, and afterwards he lifted up his eyes, he saw the aisle. Right here, he sits by his tent. If you just want to say that three guys came and they responded, then you would say he saw three guys and he responded. Right? He lifted up his eyes because he was proactively looking for an opportunity to do chesed. And behold, he's excited. You know, these are not just these are subtleties that tell us the whole depth of the story. He's sitting at his tent looking for an opportunity, and behold, the exciting news, he sees three people that he can take care of to do chesed with. Right? So that's the ultimate in chesed, to look for opportunities to do chesed. By the way, just in a passing in Pasuk Hey, it says, Ve'chob haslechem v'sa'adu libchem. Right? Satisfy your heart. Right? How is heart usually spelled in the Torah? Like in Kriya Shema, Alev Vecha, with two vases. Right? Occasionally it has only one vase. Right? And Rashi cites here that the reason for that is because an angel only has one heart. Because we see two hearts, double heart, Chazal say, referring to the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination, and the Yetzer Ra, the evil inclination. Right. By the way, I studied by Rav Huttner, and Rav Huttner once saw a fellow learning by himself in the Beis Medrash. He says, where's your chavrusa? Where's your study partner? So the guy says to Rav Huttner, I'm studying with my Yetzer Tov. I'm studying with my good inclination. So Rav Huttner said, you should study with the Yetzer Hara. He's much smarter. Much, much smarter. So the Chazal say that an angel doesn't have a Yetzer Hara. They're just programmed, sort of spiritual beings that are programmed. So for them, it says a heart. So therefore, he spoke to these people. He said, satisfy your heart, libchem. Right? There's an obvious problem with this interpretation. Who were these three people?
Angels.
What did Avraham Avinu think? Well, there's different opinions, but Rashi clearly says that. But Rashi says that he told them to wash their feet because he thought they were Arabs who worshipped. Right? Rashi clearly says that he was aware that they were, that he thought they were people, didn't realize that they were angels. So it says you're libchem because they were angels. So that's a lot of discussion about that. But the Maral, the Gerari, says something fascinating. The Gerari says that it was a way he thought they were people, but it's a way that he spoke to them with kavod. Right? He said to them, satisfy your heart, one heart, as if to say to them, I know you're people, you're special people, you have mainly only good inclination. Again, to these three pagans, right, he's not only seeing that Salam Akim in them, he speaks to them in an uplifting way, showing them covet. So that's step number two, that the Big Bang is a Big Bang of chesed, of kindness. Every act of chesed that we do is an echo of that Big Bang. Right. Now, there's also something that I didn't mention on a midrashic. These are all things that should come to our mind in terms of pshat. There's on a midrashic level, the medrash, very interesting medrash that says that originally it says in pasuk beis, shlosha anasim nitzavim alav, three people standing over him. Right. Then later on, the last pasuk, last line, hu omeid alehem. He stood over them under the tree. So Medrash says, again, this is Midrashic. Medrash says, first it says, three people standing over him. That indicates that they were a higher level than him, standing over him. At the end it says, he stood over them, indicating that he's on a higher level than them. Right? Anyone anticipate sense what the answer is going to be? First it says, they stood over him. At the end, he stood over them.
He did more chesed.
So the medrash, right, beautiful. So there's a beautiful medrash that he says, "Hu omeid alehem." He stood over them. A maso mutelas alehem. They had fear for him. Michoel mirsas, Gavriel mirsas. The angels Michoel and Gavriel trembled in his presence. So on a certain level, angels are on a higher level than us because they're spiritual. Without a yetzer hara, they never fail. They don't have struggles. But when they experience an Avraham Avinu, the chesed that he did, they trembled in his presence. Again, something to think about. You know, you talk about kindness, you think it's the nice thing to do. The angels can tremble in our presence. You know, I can't help thinking about the, you know, a lot of times people look for segulas for things, omens for things. You know, there's a famous story, somewhat famous story. You know, there's a certain tradition, which I'm not sure if there's a source to it, that right after Shabbos, a man should fold his talus. What's a segula for? Shalom Bayis. I'm sure some people are very careful about that. So they say that someone once asked Rav Gifter, the Rosh Yeshiva of Telz in Cleveland, why is it a skula to fold the towel? He says, I don't know, but getting a vacuum cleaner in your hand is a bigger skula for Shalom Bayis. Right? Yeah. So, you know, I picture a guy coming home from shul on Friday night, and, sometimes it's hectic and it's left, and let's say the table's not ready yet. So I was going to get a little nervous, and first you can get, upset, he's anxious to eat, he's hungry. Then he gets, very religious, pious, and says, it says in the Gemara that two angels come to your house, and if everything is said properly, they give you a bracha, next week should be like this also, with disappointing the angels, and I say, if you think about this medrash, you think about the angels? So do an act of chesed, grab the vacuum cleaner Friday afternoon, and the angels will tremble in your presence, if you're thinking about how the angels perceive things. So I want to share with you, getting close to wrapping up, I want to share with you an insight from Rav Huttner that, to me, elevated this whole conversation. Still with me? People awake? There's a Gemara in Ksubis that it says Rish Lakish had a matar game who would teacher would say the words and the matar game would embellish it or say it in the vernacular or make it easier for people to understand. So he said to this matar game, say something about people who come to be Menachem Avil to pay a shiva call. So it says, he said, Achenu Gomlei Chasadim, our brothers who do chesed, b'nei gomlei chasadim, the children of those who do chesed, ha-machzikin bevris shal Abraham Avinu, those who hold on and follow the bris, the covenant of Abraham Avinu. We say about bris, we say, I have a bris to go to. What do we think, of course? What's a bris? Circumcision, bris, right? Here the Gemara refers to doing chesed as the bris of Abraham Avinu, the covenant of Abraham Avinu, right? And then Rav Huttner says something beautiful. What do we say at a bris? We wonder the kibbutim. After the actual bris, we say that tzetzov chosam, both bris kodesh. Right? It says is referred to Avraham Avinu, some say. And then it says that Hashem put a stamp of os bris kodesh on the body of the descendants of Avraham Avinu. So listen to Rav Huttner's words here. He says, he cites this Gemara, and he says, we see here that chesed is the os bris kodesh. It's the holy covenant, shal Avraham Avinu, hachasuma b'nafshenu. Sealed in our soul is the bris of Avraham Avinu of chesed. That means there are two brises. We say bris, there's a bris of milah, circumcision, and there's a bris of chesed, and the bris of milah is engraved on our body. The bris of chesed is engraved on our souls. Right? It's part of the soul, the makeup, spiritual makeup of a Jew, is to do chesed, the covenant of chesed. So if you go back to the original question, why it starts off by saying he appeared to him without saying who it was, right? So and then many mafarshim say this is. To get to connect it to the previous, it says him, must be referring to something earlier. So you go back to the end of the last parasha, it was talking about bris, right? So the Torah connects it to the previous story. Why? Because the previous story was about one bris, and here we're going to read about the second bris. Bris of milah and the bris of chesed. We give a lot of attention to the bris of the bris milah. Rightfully so, of course, it's a big simcha, and it's kedusha, and we address the need to make sure that we're faithful to that bris, and in terms of elevated life and spirituality, etc. And that's very, very important. At the same time, we have this bris of chesed, which is just right up there, just as important. I think it's kind of sad that if you speak too much about chesed, kindness, people say he must be in Kiruv. Or he's a fluffer when it comes to halacha, because sometimes, we rightfully so pay so much attention to the details of halacha that's so important, so crucial to us, right? But the details of chesed are just as important. The Rabbi Soloveitchik has a sefer on Rambam, which is not that well known, but in that sefer he has a story which I think I've heard before. But he says that Rav Huttner told a story that when the Chofetz Chaim wrote the Mishnah Berurah, the famous Mishnah Berurah, he went to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter to ask for haskama, approbation. Chavetz Chaim didn't really need approbation. He went to Bissol Salanta. And Bissol told him, I can't give Haskama because there's something in there that I don't agree with. Like thousands of things, Hilchos Shabbos, you know, that you can disagree with. What it's one thing is in Hilchos Yom Kippur, the Chavetz Chaim says, I don't remember if he says clearly or indicates that you have to ask Mechila before Yom Kippur. So what happens if you did something to hurt somebody, they're not aware of it. But you need to get forgiven. So the Chavetz Chaim either says or implies that you need to go to the person and say, you know, I did something terrible, I did this, hurt you, and I want you to be mochel. Bissol Salanta said, you have no right to do that. You want to get to heaven? So you tell somebody that you said something bad about them, which is going to give them pain? He says, you have no right to do that. So I can't give you Haskam. It's interesting, just a fascinating question. I need to do something for my spiritual well-being, but it's at the expense of you because it will cause you pain. So he said, the Chavetz Chaim said, it's based on this and this, Rabbeinu Yonah. He says, I know that, but we don't hold like that. So then the Chavetz Chaim was desperate. He said, so give a Haskama and write in the Haskama that you don't agree with that one thing. So it comes to Halacha, we used to people being so careful. So Salanta said, I'm afraid people will get the Sefer. They'll see I gave Haskama. They won't read the whole Haskama, so they'll think I agree to everything, and I don't agree with that. And that's central, because it involves someone else's feelings. So when we talk about the Chavetz Chaim Mishneh Berurah, you have to think about that story. So Salanta, you know, that it's as important as the details of the Halacha are. We have another covenant of bris with Avraham Avinu. I want to end with one thing to try to make this, so to speak, lemaisa or practical. You know, Rav Huttner was known for his talks were sometimes somewhat esoteric, and people. Someone once said to him, "Why don't you speak down to earth and practical?" So Rav Huttner said, "I don't understand. If I would tell you the halachas how to take a lulav, you say that's practical. If I elevate you before you take the lulav, that's not practical." No, that's also practical. But take it to a real practical level. I'd like to share one idea. We begin the Amidah, Shmon Esri, we say Avram, okay Avram, okay Yitzchak, okay Yaakov. We evoke the Avos. Right? So Rav Huttner actually says in a different context, and I sort of just put it in my own words, that could be viewed as spiritual name dropping. You know, you come to Kodesh Baruch Hu, you know, we know that our case is somewhat weak. So we say, I'm a descendant of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And he gives the example of Huttner, of someone comes to a king with a request. And the king says, you know, I'm not inclined to honor your request. But from the conversation, I see that you're a descendant of so-and-so. And I was close to that person, so I'm going to reconsider your request. So picture today, whatever we do, there's somebody related to what we do that could open doors for us if we got into. Right, so picture someone comes in, opens the door to you, you know, whatever it is, you know, a big knocker in that field, and that he could literally open up doors for you. So you come in and you present your case, and he says, you know, I'm not inclined to do that favor for you. Yeah. Then for a conversation, you mentioned where you grew up, etc. Then it comes out, oh, you're a grandson of Joe. I was his best friend. I loved your grandfather. That's a different story. I'm going to consider your request. Okay, see, okay, there's some hope here. What's the best thing that can happen next? He just found out you're Joe's great-grandson. You warmed his heart a little bit. He's looking at you. What's the best thing he could say now? You know, the more I look at you, what do I see? I see your grandfather. I see that smile. I see your mannerisms. You remind me of your grandfather. That's the best thing, because then you're really in good shape, right? So I always think to myself, we stand before Kadosh Baruch Hu, we know all our failings, we say, I'm a descendant of Avraham Avinu. Right? The best thing that can happen is that Kadosh Baruch Hu looks at us and says, you know, I see Avraham Avinu in you. I see you do chesed. Then we're in a much better place. So hopefully these thoughts will help make us all, including myself, more sensitive to this important covenant of chesed and bris. And we stand before Kodosh Baruch Hu. We should remind him of Avraham Avinu, and our tefillah should all be received with positively, and all of our requests should be granted.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.